So today we have a very, very relevant and very important subject to discuss. There were some requests from email, through email, and we should have a discussion on this interesting topic. So that's why I took up this subject. So the subject we are discussing is a very short poem, poetical work by Adi Shankaracharya. So when you talk about Shankaracharya, there are many things that he did, and there are many great accomplishments by which he is counted as one of the immortals of human civilization. I cannot do better justice than by quoting the well-known analysis or rather summary of Shankaracharya's life and work by Sister Nivedita, who is maybe the greatest disciple, Western disciple of Swami Vivekananda. And she did not know Sanskrit, and she did not have access to the original works of Sanskrit. But she, it said that she used to listen to some of these poetical classics of Shankaracharya. And of course, her own training under Swami Vivekananda equipped her to appreciate the spiritual grandeur of his poetical classics in a way that even a well-trained Sanskrit pundit in India may not be able to do. So that's the power and force that you find in a single paragraph that Sister Nivedita wrote about Shankaracharya and his accomplishments. Remember, she was born in Northern Ireland. She was, by birth, she was a Catholic, and a firebrand social critic and social reformer and educationist who started schools to teach children according to the new method of learning, which was becoming popular in Europe at that time, especially in Britain and Ireland. So I'm just quoting this important paragraph from Sister Nivedita. It is found in a short work by her, The Web of Indian Life. It's not very short, but fairly big book, around 300 pages. In that book, she gives a panoramic view and a study and analysis of Indian culture, Indian tradition, Indian philosophy, and Indian spirituality more than everything else. So she writes, Western people can hardly imagine a personality such as that of Shankaracharya. And she continues, in the course of so few years, you have nominated the founders of no less than 10 great monastic orders. Of which 6 of them still continue to prevail in India. They have fully retained their prestige to the present day. Then, and you know, Sri Shankaracharya lived only for 32 years. And he's supposed to have mastered all the 4 Vedas, including the entire Mahabharata and Puranic works, before he was 6 years, and then he became a monk. That's a story, not a story, history, so to speak. And she continues, to have acquired such a mass of Sanskrit learning as to create a distinct philosophy and impress himself on the scholarly imagination of India in a preeminence that 1200 years have not sufficed to shake. She's writing this at the beginning of 20th century, most probably 1901, before Swamiji's passing away. And Shankaracharya lived in the 8th century AD, so 1200 years almost. That's what she says. 1200 years have not diminished or decreased the relevance and the importance of Shankaracharya's work and his teachings. to have written poetic works whose grandeur makes them unmistakable, even to the foreign and unlearned ear. At the same time, to have lived with his disciples in all the radiant joy and simple pathos of the saints, this is a greatness that we may appreciate but can never understand. And she continues, one more line. We contemplate the wonder and delight the devotion of Saint Francis of Assisi, the founder of Franciscan order, the intellect of Abelard. Abelard was a great French scholastic philosopher, a poet, a musician, a composer, and a theologian. That's one of the greatest names in the Christian theological tradition. So she says, we contemplate with wonder and delight the devotion of Saint Francis of Assisi, the intellect of Abelard, the force and freedom of Martin Luther. He was a great revolutionary because his new interpretation of Vedic philosophy was his greatest contribution, because without Shankaracharya's works, Vedic literature would not have any philosophy, because Vedas are a huge mass of literature. Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda, Atharvaveda, and each of these four Vedas has got Samhita, Brahmana, Aranyaka, Upanishad. It's a huge mass of literature. And he was the one who wrote a commentary on the Vedic literature, and he built up this philosophical system which we now call Vedanta, which in 19th century Vivekananda preached in America from 1893 to 1897. This is history. So this man, he wrote 91 great poetical classics, of which the shortest one is this one we are going to discuss today. That is Matru Panchakam. I mean, five poems dealing with the sanctity and sacredness of the and the spirituality of the relationship between a mother and her child. And in that one of the lines, Shankaracharya says, even a Napoleon Bonaparte, in modern language, let me put it that way, would be a child for his mother. Alexander the Great would be only child for his mother. And Shankaracharya was the greatest name in Indian philosophical tradition at that time, and also now, after 1200 years. And he says, I can never express my indebtedness, my gratitude, my sense of obligation to my mother, other than just bowing down before her with folded arms. That's how each single verse concludes. That's why he says, we contemplate with wonder and delight the devotion of Saint Francis of Assisi, the intellect of Abelard, the force and freedom of Martin Luther, and the political efficiency of Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order. Shankaracharya founded 10 monastic orders. Remember, you can never go to India. You may travel entire Indian subcontinent. You can never meet a monk in this ochre cloth who doesn't belong to one of the 10 monastic orders of Shankaracharya. This 1200 years after his passing away. That's an interesting thing. So, but who could imagine all these united in one person? So that is Sister Nivedita on Shankaracharya. I don't think anyone, even a Sanskrit Pandit, whom often frequently spends decades studying Shankaracharya's philosophy and works, won't be able to put anything like this. Because when a new student coming from a new culture, new tradition, when he or when she, when she comes in contact with such a grand philosophical, spiritual, literary tradition, she had no words to express. So that is the intimacy and the strength and force and the grandeur of the language that she used while trying to sum up Shankaracharya's personality and his accomplishments. Of course, Dr. Radhakrishnan K.M. Munshi, the founder of Bhari Vidya Bhavan, Gandhi himself have written a lot of, Nehru, of course, in the Discovery of India. So they have all written, but nothing comes anywhere close to Sister Nivedita. Now I'm coming straight to the subject. As I mentioned, these are five verses. I'm not sure if I will be able to complete this entire work today, because though these are all very, very short verses, but they're loaded with meaning and significance, not philosophical significance, but cultural, civilizational, humanistic aspects of this work is beyond words to explain. So I will try. First, I shall try to give a short description in English of these five verses. First, the background. How he happened to write this work, Matra Panchakam. You know, he left his home when he was 6 years old, and he passed away when he was 32 years. He passed away almost 30 miles from Tibetan border, Indo-Tibetan border. That is high up in the Himalayas, Kedarnath. That may be roughly around 3,500 miles, maybe close to 4,000 miles from the place where he was born. And then there is something about the history, how he happened to become a monk. It is said that his parents didn't have children for a long time, and they used to pray. They used to go to a temple, a Shiva temple, and pray. And his father felt that Lord Shiva appeared in a dream and asked him whether you wanted a child who will live for 100 years or who will have a very short lifespan, but he'll be very brilliant. If you choose the former, a child, a son who will live for 100 years, he will not be very intelligent, he will not be very well educated, he will be a bit of a dunce. But if you want a son who have a short lifespan, he will be the brightest human being born in this world. Which do you want? The father said, no, I would rather have a son who is brilliant, who is great, and that's what I want. I don't want a son who is not brilliant, who is not intelligent, but who may live for 100 years or longer. And as a result, Shankaracharya was born. Now, you can find in one of these, one of the poems, the second one, the second line is very important. I shall take up one after another. The second line is, Gurukulama samuvetya supnakale tu drishta yadi samuchita vesham prarudo mam tumuchaihi Gurukulamatha sarvam prarudatte samaksham sabadi charanayoste mataha astu pranamaha. The second of the five verses. I'm just trying to give a glimpse of the greatness of this work. He was young. He was 5 years old, and he was studying in a Vedic hermitage with his guru, with other students and his teacher. And there, one day his mother had a dream. Now remember, he had come back to his village when he came to know that his old mother was about to pass away. And this happened when Shankaracharya himself was almost coming to the end of his life. He was in Sringeri. He was teaching students there. This is one of the important events. At that time, the son gets a vision, an intuition, well, my mother is calling me. This you may frequently happen, it may happen to in the life of many people. When your near and dear ones thinks about you, somebody whom you have real devotion and love, not hi, how are you, not that kind of thing, mind you, but rather real intimate spiritual affection, maybe brother, sister, mother. Mostly it happens between mother and children relationship. When the mother thinks about you, you may have an intuitive feeling, well, my mother is thinking about me. this frequently happens. This happened to many people. And it depends upon the intimacy of the relationship between mother and children. So when Shankaracharya was already maybe 30 years or 31 years, they've been 1 year before his passing away, perhaps, he got this feeling, my mother is calling me. And he comes to his village, he sees his mother in deathbed. You know why this happened? When he was a child, when he took permission from his mother to become a monk, because it was a great difficulty he got it, then his mother made him swear, take an oath, that he will come and meet her, see her when she is in her deathbed. So this happened when he was about to leave his village as a monk, going in search of a guru. He traveled 1300 miles to Indore, Omkareshwar, to meet his guru, Govinda Bhavapada. So as he was starting his journey, spiritual journey, he had to give word, the promise to his mother, well, whenever you are in need of me, at her request, she requested, you know, when I'm before my death, I want to see you again as a monk. He agreed, he promised, whenever you think about me, I shall come there. When this teacher, when Shankaracharya was in Sringeri teaching his students, at that time he got this intuition, the intuitive feeling, well, my mother is wanting to see me. And he comes to the village and sees and prays for her, and according to tradition, enables her to pass away, to die with a blissful feeling, get a vision of his her own deity. His Shankaracharya prayed to Vishnu, and Vishnu gave him darshan, I mean vision, and the mother passed away in perfect bliss. Now, as he had come back to Kaladi, this place where he was born in South Indian Kerala, as he was standing in front of the mother who is just about to pass away, at that time these thoughts came to his mind, the love and affection with which she had brought him up. And one episode he remembers, that is portrayed in the second verse of the Matru Pancham. So it is Gurukulam Samuved Samusutya Sapnakale Tu Dushta. In dream, one day she saw her little child had become a monk, which in Hindu tradition means you should have absolutely no contact with your parents, brother, or anyone. You should be totally detached, because the whole humanity becomes your relatives. Every woman is a mother, and every man is a father for a monk. A monk should look upon every woman as a manifestation of mother. And every person is like father. He should be respectful. So this great philosopher suddenly is remembering an episode that happened to him when he was 5 years old, studying in a Vedic hermitage. So he says, "O mother, once in your dreams, you saw me as a child, clad in the dress of a monk. And you rushed to the Gurukula." Gurukula means the Vedic hermitage. "And you wept aloud." The entire Gurukula, the Vedic hermitage, the teacher, the students who assembled there, they also wept with you. What affection you had. Because when a mother feels, or she gets a dream that her son is becoming a monk, on the one hand, the joy of her son becoming a spiritual teacher, but that is in total contrast to her own sense of loss. She is losing her son, but the son is actually embracing the entire humanity as his family. So, but then a mother cannot easily bear that separation. So she cried and wept, and then the teacher, the philosopher, is remembering this episode. that happened when he was only 5 years old. And the entire Gurukula, the Vedic hermitage, wept and cried along with him. So just one sample of this verse. And like the 5 verses. So now I'm coming one after another. I shall discuss each and every single verse here. The first one is this. I shall just read and I will explain. Astam tavadiyam prasudhi samaye durvara shulavyatha nairuchyam tanishoshanam malamayi shayya cha sambatsari ekasyabi na garbhara bharana kleshasya yasyakshamu dadum niskrutim unnatopi tanayastasyai janane namaha. So it concludes with saying tasyai janane namaha. To that mother I bow down. This is the conclusion. And what mother? So he says, he's referring to the pain that his mother must have endured at the time of delivery. The pain. So there is a very powerful expression, you know, durvara shula vyatha. So the mother must have felt she's being pierced with a spear, the pain, the physical pain and suffering. Remember, you have to think of 8th century AD, not modern hospitals. You know. Think of those times. So there was no medical care or anything. The mother must have endured so much of pain, sufferings at the time of delivery. And then the mother then carries and delivers the baby. But also for the first 1 year, she has to take care of the baby after birth, after childbirth. And she had to share the same bed with his child lays, and you know, child, little baby will naturally a lot of difficulties, complications, which I don't want to discuss further. But there is one, malamayi shayya cha sambatsari. For first 1 year, mother had to share the bed of the little baby, and the bed will not be clean. So she goes through all these sufferings, all for the sake of the mother, for the child, for the baby. And this is how it begins. And then ekasyabi na garbhara bharana kleshasya yasyakshamu. Now, and what amount of pains, difficulties the mother had to endure. And then there are nairuchyam tanishoshanam. The two words are used, you know, when a mother is carrying a baby, she will lose her taste for food. She will also suffer a lot of difficulties, bodily pains and sufferings. All these are referred to in poetic language, which there is no need to explain it in so many words. So, but the point is, and that the great burden that with which the mother brings up that baby in the early first 1 or 2 years, and all this, no son, however accomplished he may be. That's why, you know, niskriti means gratitude, indebtedness, that a son or a daughter, that son or daughter should feel towards his or her mother. So the niskriti. Unnatopi, the son may be a great philosopher, a saint, a military general, the most powerful man in the world, but he cannot pay back even a fraction of his obligation and indebtedness to his mother or to her mother if it is a woman. And that's why it is said that, you know, when, of course, in spiritual tradition, because Shankara was a great monk, so in monastic tradition, when you become a monk in Hindu tradition and also in Buddhist tradition, when you become a monk, you deserve honor from everyone, including your father and grandfather, but not from your mother. In the presence of your mother, even the greatest monk should fall down, pay respects, what you call it, namaskara we call it in Sanskrit. before a mother, even a Shankaracharya or a Vivekananda or a Ramakrishna Paramahamsa had to bow down. That way, you know, you find in Sri Ramakrishna's life. He was living in Vrindavan, and there were many great devotees in Vrindavan, far away from Bengal where he was born. But he felt like staying there, but then suddenly the thought of his own biological mother, not Bhavatarini, but his biological mother was at that time staying in Dakshineswar. So that thought made him rush back to Dakshineswar. That's how the story goes. Vivekananda, you know, after all this work in the US and elsewhere, he went back to India, and when he met his mother, he was just like a child that he was when he was growing up. That's why a monk deserves honor from everyone except his own mother, because he should honor the mother. He should prostrate before the mother. That's a grandeur of this particular, the connection between a mother and child. Now, according to tradition, when Shankara returned to the village, when he saw his mother was just about to pass away, all these thoughts came back to his mind. And you find in this verse, sometimes he says, "Oh, I could not stay with you all my life. I became a monk. And I'm not in a position, I won't be able to perform your after death ceremony, because a monk is not supposed to perform after death ceremony, because that ceremony is performed even when the parents are alive as part of the rituals of ordination into monkhood in Hindu tradition. But in Shankaracharya's case, he made an exception. He performed this after death ceremony of the mother. That historically, there are the reasons for that. The next verse I mentioned already, Gurukulam samusrutya svapnakale tu drishtva yadi samuchita vesham prarudha mam tam uccaihi. You cried and wept loudly when you had a dream the previous day, the previous night, when you dreamt that your son had become a monk. You could not bear that, the separation. You wanted your child to be with you all the time. That affection, that love, how, what can I do by way of giving back to you? That is the force of the argument. But I tell you, more than everything else, you may consider this as a great spiritual work written by a saint in 8th century. But actually, this spiritual dimension of the relationship between mother and children is the foundation of any civilization, any culture. Upon this depends upon the very foundation of family. It's a very important point. When the institution of family collapses, it is equivalent to the entire collapse of human civilization and culture. In any society where you find family values are degraded, ignored, or become transactional, become a matter of legal document, that civilization is in a downward spiral. It is very close to its extinction. That's what happens. On the other hand, you find in the history of many ancient civilizations, if they still survive today, in spite of thousands of years of foreign domination, invasions, genocides, massacres, extinction of entire populations, still they survive as a civilization, as a culture, as a cultural paradigm. It is because if you search enough, you find beneath a spark of this spark of the sanctity and sacredness that they attach to family values. And the foundation of family values is motherhood. A woman can become divine by becoming an ideal mother. This is a very important point to remember. That's why in Hindu tradition, the most sublime aspect of the divine is the feminine archetype. Many people, and in modern times, have found and have heard, seeing the picture of Kali, Durga, all the Hindu mother goddesses and all that, They think this is not God. This is not a God. It is symbol. Kali, Durga, these are all symbols. Protection, blessings, preservation. That's why, you know, that is bhukti, mukti pradayini. That is the definite, that's the most archetypal definition of feminine divine archetype. It's found in Lalita Sahasranama and also in Chandi and other books to find. When you look upon the divine, any god and god, or any concept of monotheistic religious god idea, when you think of the divine as a all-loving, all-compassionate mother, you can find she on the one hand gives you shelter, food, clothing, everything right from the day you are born, but she also shows the door to spiritual enlightenment, that is mukti. So bhukti and mukti, that is the important definition of the divine feminine archetype. People who don't understand this symbolism behind, the spiritual symbolism behind, it is an ideal. It is not kind of a physically visible form that you find somebody sitting, a lady sitting on a horseback, or maybe on a lion, for example, or lady with fully armed. That's not the concept of the divine archetype in Hinduism. That is absolutely, absolutely wrong, and is total gibberish to interpret that goddess is sitting there in a lion or on the top of a lion or a horseback, nothing like that. It is symbol. For example, Kali, the divine. See, think of it. Kali is the one who protects you when you are facing a challenge, a problem. And Kali is the one who gives you food, that is bhukti. And she is the one who eventually tells you everything in this world is impermanent. You should look for some transcendental value. You should look for spiritual enlightenment. That also is a gift from Kali. So people who don't understand this symbolism, they see the picture. An image is not God. Image is a symbol. It is a spiritual symbolism behind. And the highest symbolism, Hindu tradition, Advaitic tradition. Remember, it was Shankaracharya who actually gave us Advaita. Remember. And the same man who told you, you need not go to a temple and worship any god and goddess. You meditate and find out your own true nature. Atma rupanu santhanam bhaktihi iti abhidhiyade. That is Shankaracharya's definition of bhakti in Vivekachudamani. You understand your own true nature. That is devotion. But then, at the same Shankaracharya wrote, Gadistum Gadistum Tomega Bhavani. Divine Mother, you are the only ultimate refuge. So how can Advaitin write about self-surrender? Advaitin alone can really write something authentic on self-surrender. I tell you, this is not anywhere. No. Even when I was teaching some of the scriptures years ago in India, one Brahmachari, one of our own trainees, was the day Shankaracharya's Jayanti means birth anniversary, puja was being celebrated. He was a great musician, so he was with harmonium, tabla, you know, there is Bhavani Ashtagam, eight verses on Divine Mother. And every verse concludes with the statement, Gadistum Gadistum Tomega Bhavani. Or Divine Mother, you are the only refuge. And that person, the following day, asked me a question, why did Shankaracharya condemn devotion? Then I asked him, yesterday you were reciting this verse. Who composed that? Shankaracharya. That's the greatest line on devotion and self-surrender. The greatest line on devotion and self-surrender is the concluding part of the Bhavaniyashtakam. So people are so much of ignorance. They are so ignorant of the basic fundamental teachings of Vedanta and Hinduism, unfortunately. But here what you are finding is the same concept of divinity is attached to your own biological mother. Why? Because if you don't take care of your mother, no God will listen to you. That's an important principle in Hinduism. You find many stories in the Upanishads and Vedas, Puranas. Some sage, some ascetic, leaving his home, went to go into forest and meditating, and suddenly he meets a sage who tells him, "You have completely neglected your own family. You have taken care of your children, your mother and father. No, go back. That's the first religion." You find many such stories in Hindu tradition. Even close to our own times, Sri Ramakrishna is the greatest example. You know, in Dakshinesha, there is one man sitting right in front of Sri Ramakrishna's room, Azra. He has much bigger, he looked as a greater devotee than Sri Ramakrishna. He wanted to pose as a much greater mystic than Sri Ramakrishna. With a big sitting asana, he used to sit there pompously. And he was also acting as like a marriage broker also. A side business was acting as a marriage broker. And also meditating. Whenever people came, he would be closing his eyes in meditative posture. Sri Ramakrishna found out from some sources that somebody had come from his village to call him back to his home, where his children were starving, their mother was starving, wife was starving. Sri Ramakrishna asked him, "You fellow, get back, go back to your home." Sri Ramakrishna used some strong language which I don't want to refer to. Sri Ramakrishna was so impatient when people practice so much of hypocrisy in the name of spirituality. So he completely forget humanism, compassion, all the basic values which are the natural ingredients of spiritual culture, spiritual tradition, any spiritual tradition for the matter. After that, you become some kind of, you obsess with some blind rituals. So Sri Ramakrishna asked that fellow, "Go back to your village, take care of your children, your mother, and your relatives." That's the first response, your wife and others. So you can find this very much. So what happens is here, when you attach a spiritual connection, a spiritual element to your own relationship with your mother, what happens is, it becomes a spiritual ideal that preserves families, preserves human relations, and it gives a kind of sanctity and sacredness to human interaction that is totally absent in any transactional culture, where every year you request for an appointment to your mother, who may be 90 years you don't ever talk to your mother anytime. And it says, sometime I heard reports that children frequently came to know of the passing of their parents only from some public agencies, and they send a check for the cremation expenses. That's how it happens. And what happens, such a civilization is bound to perish. Why? The foundation of human civilization is culture. Family values are completely ignored. The foundation is gone, the entire edifice building collapses. So here, it's an example. The great philosopher, the greatest philosopher of Vedantic tradition, whose teaching Vivekananda brought to America in 1893 and distributed globally. Today we are discussing Vedanta because Vivekananda brought this to America and Western world in 19th century. And that teacher tells you, "Well, mother, I still remember the day when I was a small child studying the Vedas in Gurukula, hermitage school, 6 year old, 5 year old. At that time, you had a dream. Oh, you had lost your son because your son had become a monk. It means he will have no more exclusive connection with his mother. And you wept and cried. Next day you came, rushed to the Gurukula, wept and cried. And the teacher, he also wept with you. And other students also wept with you, crying. This is the interesting thing. The third one is more realistic. Nadattam madaste marana samaye toyam apiva suthavanu deya marana divase sadha vidhina. Na japto madaste marana samaye taragamanu akale samprapte mai kuru dayam mataha aturam. This is a third one. What it says is this: "O mother, I could not offer water at the time of your death." Remember, this verse, according to scholars, doesn't really reflect Shankaracharya's own experience. Here he's talking, placing himself in the role of a person who could not come to see his mother at the time of her death. So, because in Shankaracharya's case, he did come and he did after the ceremony, though it's not normally done by monks, but in Shankaracharya's case, because all great mystics go beyond established norms and rules. They transcend. They don't go against them, they transcend. So anyway, here he is giving an example of what happens when a son forgets his obligations and doesn't come to the mother's deathbed at the last minute, and is not able to perform some of the duties and responsibilities of a son to his ailing mother. So, mother, I couldn't offer water to you at the time of your death. I cannot offer food on the anniversary of your death by performing sadha. Sadha means after death ceremony. I have not chanted the redeeming Tairaga mantra in your ears. And mother, be compassionate and forgive me. And my tributes to you. So, Nadattam Madhaste Marana Samaye. You know, normally, in Indian tradition, when a mother passes away, the son or daughter is supposed to sprinkle Ganges water on mother's face, or if possible, make her drink a few drops of Ganges water. I couldn't do that because I'm too late in coming here. And then Sudha Vanu Deya. Sudha is a mantra uttered at the time of Sadha. Sadha, Sudha, Sudha, all these are different Swaha, Sudha, different mantras are there, different locations. So Sudha is a mantra that is associated with ceremonies at the time of offering when you perform after the ceremony of departed souls. I couldn't do that. So here he is placing himself in the position of somebody who happens to come there too late. And then najapto madaste marana samaye taraga manu, taraga mantra. Taraga mantra means a chanting, an incantation. If you chant a special mantra, an auspicious mantra, that will help the departed soul to cross the ocean of samsara. He or she will not be born again. She'll get enlightenment, liberation from the cosmic cycle. That is called Taraga. Taraga means something like a boat that helps you to cross the river, the ocean, going beyond. You are no more to be born again as part of the samsara, this cosmic cycle. You know, birth, life, enjoyment and suffering, happiness, unhappiness, death, again rebirth. So you'll be liberated from this cosmic cycle. That's the greatness and relevance of this Taraga mantra. It could be Omkara Pranava, it could be Rama mantra. These are different forms. There are also some Vedic mantras which are also called Taraga mantra. And some people recite mantras in which are found in the second chapter of the Gita. Najayati Mrida Muride Vakajadi Nayam Bhutta Bhavidana, like in the second chapter of the Gita, there are a few mantras which are supposed to be auspicious when you want to chant when somebody is passing away. Because if the person is not able to hear, then mantra will help that departed soul to get spiritual liberation after death. And mother, I couldn't do that. I'm a bit too late. Akale samprapte mai. So, akale samprapte. I came, akala means a bit too late. Not the right time. I'm a bit late. So, please, atulam dayam kuru. Mataha, atulam dayam kuru. Oh mother, please show extreme compassion and kindness to me. So, he's apologizing. Now, again, After this, there is another one which is more touching. That is fourth one. Muktamanistum nayanam mameti rajedi jivedi chiram sutastum ityuktavatyaha tava vachi mataha dadamyaham tanduramev shushkam. So the first two lines are very touching. Here Shankaracharya is remembering his early days when his mother used to hold him in her lap, shoulders, singing songs and calling him by endearing terms, you know. So Muktamani means my jewel. You know, frequently mothers, grandmothers use those terms while addressing their grandchildren, so either son or daughter. So he remembering those wonderful, endearing terms by which his mother used to call him, used to show her love and affection for the baby. So he used to call me Muktamani, Muktamani jewel. And again, it's very interesting, you know, Nayanam mameti, Rajeti, Jeevaiti. So his mother used to call him, you are my diamond, you are my life, you are my king, Chiram Suta, may you live long. There is an interesting aspect to this last part. That means Chira Suta Tuam, Suta Tuam Chira, Chiram Suta Tuam Chiram. What it means, you see, it means may you live long, may you remain eternal, immortal. This is the expression she used to use when the child was growing up. Baby, not child, but it was baby at that time. So the reason is, she is remembering the background of Shankara's birth. His father was a great ascetic, great devotee, pray to God, and his God gave vision and asked him to choose between a long-lived, rather dull son or a brilliant, bright, short-lived one. And his father wanted somebody who will immortalize his lineage, somebody who is brilliant, wise, spiritual. So he was supposed to live only for 32 years, short lifespan. So mother remembers that. So mother is praying, oh son, may you remain immortal, eternal. There is Suda, son, Chiram, Tum Chiram, Bhava, means may you live long. So with this prayer, the mother used to bring up the child, the baby. So calling him by all these endearing names. I mean, you are diamond, you are my eyes, and you are like my king. And Jiveti Chiram, may you live long with these prayers. So they can be very interesting, you can imagine. And then you have to remember, the great world philosopher is remembering all this when he's sitting, maybe standing right in front of his dying mother. Or mother must have already just passed away. That's a memory that comes to him. So he remembers those times, those days. Iti uktavatyaha tava vachi mataha. He used to speak like this. He used to use all these endearing words, showing your affection, your prayer for my long life, for my prosperity. And then he says, Dadamyaham tandulam eva shushkam. Shushkam tandulam. See, tandulam actually is a dry rice. Shushkam means dry. Tandulam means rice. Aham didami. I am now giving you only small pouch of dry rice. Now, I have to explain this. You know, Hindu tradition, when somebody passes away, he is supposed to begin his journey that will take him to the higher world, and you're praying for his ascent to a higher celestial regions after his passing away. So you give him something, or give her something, in this case mother, something that she'll carry with her. And the traditional, we should remember, these are ancient customs and rituals practiced by a civilization for thousands of years. And at that time, the well-refined rice was not available. So whatever rice was, dry rice, a very rough kind of rice, roughly equivalent to a crude form of modern-day brown rice, you may call it. That's the only thing I'm giving you back. In return for all the affection, for all the care, all the all the attention, all the love and compassion, all that you showed me, right from my birth, calling me by all these endearing terms, you brought me up. In return to this, I'm able to give only this small tiny pouch of dry rice, which they used to keep along the dead body when it's being cremated. It's a normal practice. In India, they used to cremate the body, burn their body, pick body, five elements, they are bound to change and they are bound to perish. Bhasma sat guru deyanjaya. Entire body is bound, it is not made, supposed to be immortal. Main difference between the Egyptian civilization and the Vedic civilization is, that's one of the major differences. There are many other differences, but this is the most important difference with regard to cremation ceremony. In Hindu tradition, they burn their body because the body came from five elements. And they go back to five elements. The five elements take the gross form and the human body. They go back to the subtle form when you burn. In Egyptian tradition, sometimes in Assyrian tradition, they used to think that body is eternal. So they developed this wonderful technology of preserving human body. You can find the pyramids and so on. It's a different aspect. So here, the great philosopher saint says, Aham dadami, I'm giving you only what? Shushkam tandulameva, this dry, crude grains of rice, nothing else. In return for all the affection, for all the care, for all the attention sacrifices that you endured for bringing me up. I think we'll conclude this discussion in the next class, maybe next sometime when I'm speaking in the next session. I don't know, maybe not this month. Most probably there'll be no lecture, my lecture this month. Maybe in January sometime we'll conclude the last two verses. We'll further explain and we'll conclude with few more details. Okay, thank you. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.